So,
Yes.
well, first of all, welcome. We know that you're very busy. I know you just finished a long teaching day, and actually you shortened your day to join us for this teleconference interview. It's greatly appreciated. Anna Vravaka is actually going to be one of the international speakers at the Joint American Conference from April 8th through the 10th in Alexandria, Virginia. If you want more information about that event, you can go to the National Center for Homeopathy website, which is www.homeopathic.org, and then you'll see right there at the front page is a link for the conference event. This is really a star-studded event. We've got unbelievably high-level speakers, webcasts with George Vitolkis, Jeremy Scherer, Dr. Joe Kellerstein, Annette Snivellet, Miranda Castro. I will also be one of the speakers, Alistair Gray, Farouk Master, and, of course, Anna Vravaka will be there as well. Oh, and I forgot Massimo Mangilavori. So, really, this is amongst the best recognized and most highly sought-after homeopathic instructors and practitioners in the world today. Really, it's a golden opportunity to meet with the greatest, Will Taylor, I forgot also, the greatest practitioners that are out there, and also to meet with your colleagues and your friends in the homeopathic community. On top of that, there will be the unveiling of a very important video. It's called Homeopathy Around the World, about the effect that global homeopathy is actually having, changing people's lives around the planet. And this is going to be a one-hour documentary showing the positive effects of homeopathy from around the world. It really will be a an amazing event. So let me give Anna a quick introduction. So hold on 1 second. So, first of all, Anna Vravaka is somebody I consider a good friend and a colleague, and she's been around in the homeopathic community for quite a while. She trained in classical homeopathy in Belgium and in the Netherlands at the School for Homeopathy in Bloemendaal and Amersfoort, and she also established the Center for Classical Homeopathy in Leuven, Belgium, which I had an opportunity to visit recently, beautiful little town. And she organizes a 5-year training course, a postgraduate course, a yearly seminar, and an international training. Anne has also served as the program creator, teacher, and director for over 15 years. She also has a private clinic since 1989. And Anna Vravaka has developed her own style of practice, which she calls the AV method, or what's the full expression of the... Anna, how do you say the full expression of it? It's the...
Vital approach.
But,
Hi, Tim. The vital approach. And it's a little joke because then it's VA. And, you know, the initials of my name is AV.
I see. Okay, AV. Okay, I thought it was vital approach. So it's actually based on her 20 years of accumulated teaching experience, seminar attendance, and investigation in her private practice. And it's largely based on the work of Rajan Sankaran, but she combines it with her classical knowledge of homeopathy and insights from phenomenology and linguistics. She currently coordinates international trainings and seminars, teaches at the Center for Classical Homeopathy, and offers postgraduate seminars, a master class, and online training. Anna has also published some novels and 2 books on homeopathy in Dutch for the general public. And I've tried to say these names, Classic Homeopathy, Niet te Geloven, I'm sure I pronounced that incorrectly.
Great.
And 250 Jaar na Hahnemann. And also in English, she's published a couple of books. One is called The Charm of Homeopathy, which describes how she developed her method, the vital approach method. And also a book called The Postgraduate Annual 2006, which is a succinct overview of her method, demonstrating its value in daily practice in both adult and pediatric cases. And I also know that Anna has prepared a lovely work now of very good cured cases of smaller remedies that we don't, that people oftentimes have difficulty recognizing in practice. And I think this is going to be invaluable, and it's going to actually be made available through the Opus software program very soon. So we're really pleased to have you on. Anna, as always, we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us, and thank you so much.
Oh, wow. That was an introduction, Kim. Thank you.
You're very welcome, of course. So I know that the topic that you've chosen for the Joint American Conference, the one that's in Alexandria, Virginia, from April 8th to the 10th, is back pain. And I'm curious, is there a specific reason that you chose back pain as a topic?
It's a little bit to demonstrate that the advantage or the value of the what I call the vital approach, as you already mentioned, in a disease or in a pathology that is usually considered as quite mechanical. Like it is so physical, it's even mechanical part of the physical body, and yet the how to prescribe for the patient, of course, the patient with the back pain. And this is what I will try to demonstrate by two cases, that you can use it always and in every kind of case and in every kind of pathology. There's no specific cases that are good for sensation method or vital approach and other cases that you have to refer to other methods. For instance, clinical prescription or whatever. So I think even with children or with babies, you can use the vital approach.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
That was my main reason.
Do you feel that there's a special approach specifically necessary with the pathology of back pain, or what is your feeling about this?
Or well, that I would go, that I would take the consultation or do the consultation in the same way, like, in the end, you do the same thing. Of course, you have to adjust to your patient and to the personality of your patient and the age and whatever. But in fact, as a homeopath, there's no specializations. You have to be either specialist in everything. That's one way to put it. Or basically, you're doing the same thing. You're always trying to find, to understand, to spot the vital disturbance. It's a pattern. I call it a pattern. And what we do is trying to spot the pattern. And then later, when we see the pattern in the disturbance, we can match it to the pattern of the remedy. And either in back pain or whatever patient, you do exactly the same. And you can do it with full success.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, I'm imagining that people on the call are not that familiar with your approach. I know you're teaching quite a bit in Europe and in other parts of the world, and you do travel around. But I know that you've only been to the United States a few times, mostly in the Bay Area. So perhaps you could share with the audience a little bit about your approach so they have some sense of really what it is.
Sure. I've been in Boston before. At Melissa Birch's place, who is working with the sensation method as well. But you're right, many people are not very familiar with the vital approach. I give it a different name because it's not exactly the same as the sensation method. And, of course, in my opinion, it has some advantages. Otherwise, it would be no need to give it a different name. So what is specific? The basic idea or the underlying idea is that the disturbance with anybody, in every case, is on the vital level. Now, the vital level or the fifth level, I try to explain, is beyond mind and body, because if you read the Organon, that is what Hahnemann says, disease is a disturbance of the vital force expressing itself with signs and symptoms on mind and body. So, in line with Hahnemann, I'd call it vital sensation or vital approach. He calls it a disturbance on the vital force or the dynamis. It's all the same. And it's expressing itself by signs and symptoms on mind and body, meaning the problem is not coming from the mind onto the body, but is coming from a source beyond and expressing in the same coded way on both levels. So, therefore, I use this five-level diagram where you see the vital level, and then you have two levels representing the body. Level one is the physical material body. Level two is the energetic functional aspect of the physical body. So one and two is body. And then you have level three and four, that is mind. Level three is the emotional aspect of the mind, and level four is the mental aspect of the psyche. So on all those levels, you can find signs and symptoms or disturbance in sensations and functions. That's the words of the Organon. And all together, the totality of all those symptoms make the picture of the disease. So it is classical based, but it is with the underlying idea that we're looking for this source of disease. The expressions or the symptoms we have are only a pointer to the source. and explain my cases, how to go about in case taking and what repercussions this has. But it's quite simple. The theory, I mean, the great outlines of the theory is quite simple.
It's very interesting. But, you know, I'm sorry, did you want to continue?
No, I was asking myself, is that enough? Does it make
it
clear?
No, it's very interesting. But let me, just for the purposes of clarification, maybe for, you know,
sure,
people on the call so they can understand even a little bit better. So, you know,
sure,
I understand you're dividing the different types of phenomenological events that can occur in a person's life into, you know, mental, emotional, physical, and then, of course, you talk about the really underlying disturbance, the mistunement of the life force or vital force, as the thing which is, so how will you recognize that disturbance on the vital level? Because of course on the physical level you can see, you know there's this pain, or there's this modality or this concomitant. On the mental emotional level you see, you know, certain mental symptoms, cognitive issues or emotional problems. But how do you recognize the disturbance on the vital or at the vital level?
That's a very good question, because it's not simple. That's the hardest part, because not only for the homeopath, but especially for the patient, because the patient doesn't know what you're looking for. So he understands that you want to know everything about his physical complaints. The patient understands very well that you are interested in his mind, his emotions, in his personality, and the way he perceives the world. But then you keep asking questions for something deeper, and sometimes the patient is a bit puzzled, like, what do you want more of me? And what do we want more? What we do want is to have this experience behind this thinking and this feeling. Like, and the experience, by definition, is the same on mind and body. But it's very hard to put words to it, because the patient never did it. That's the way he is. For him, there is only way to be, namely, the way he is. Patient doesn't know that somebody else experienced himself and the world differently. Because nobody never asks. Nobody ever asks somebody, how do you experience this? It is not a thought. It's not an image from the mind. It is an experience of mind and body. And in the beginning, it's a little bit odd, and the patients are a bit puzzled, and you have to question or to know how to question further. But very often, it comes quite naturally. If you continue asking a patient, like, yeah, I see this is your problem, and so you're afraid this and this will happen, I see you're worried about this and this, so how it is for you to have this worry, for instance? And then they're a bit puzzled, like, what do you mean? How is it in your life to have this kind of problem? I see the problem, but how is it to have this problem? And then you get this vital information. Then the patient will say, well, I don't know. It's like my fundament crumbling away under my feet. If my partner goes or whatever, let's say the patient has a fear of being alone, of losing his partner or whatever, and then how is this fear? They can say, well, if this would happen, my whole life would crumble. I have no ground to stand on. Then, you know, this is an experience. And the experience, then you can say, oh, now I understand the kingdom where you belong to, now I understand the issue, the underlying motivation. And I give only one example with mineral. It could be that the patient would say, well, it is so painful. Just imagine this pain, I would never survive. And then you have, like, what do you normally consider as a very superficial symptom, like pain? You can have pain in the body and pain in the mind, but you can have pain as life experience. And then you know, aha, this is plant kingdom. This patient is talking of experiencing even a break in the relationship as pain, even, let's say, losing his job as painful. Actually experiencing everything in his life as very painful. And then it becomes a repetitive, specific pain or feeling in mind and body, and then you know you're in plant kingdom, etc. But not everybody is capable of exactly describing it. Only, let's say, give examples and analogies, etc. But we have methods to recognize it on all levels.
So, Anne, I'm curious, in your own practice, Do you find that you're always using the vital approach, or is there sometimes that you simply rely on, you know, physical symptoms, physical generals, or mental and emotionals, or is it a combination of both? I mean, what is the demographics of your own practice in terms of the vital approach relative to looking at the more physical or mental emotional symptoms?
Well, I would use the methods in every case, but I don't think that physical symptoms are of lesser importance. Very often, only by the physical symptoms you can make a vital prescription. As long as you know how to differentiate or to make discernment between what belongs to the pathology, what belongs to the context, and what belongs to the state. And when it belongs to the state, it must be vital. Of course, if you only have symptoms from, for instance, the physical complaints, though they might be very specific, you have only a confirmation that they're general and not local when you have the same thing on a different level. But I very often have a patient who describes his physical complaint, be it his migraine or his eczema, and even by the characteristics of this physical complaint, you can determine this must be plant kingdom, or this is for sure animal kingdom, and even if you know your remedies well, you can even say which plant or which plant family. But even I might have an idea after 10 or 15 minutes, I will still check for 2 hours, all levels, to be sure.
So I'm curious because I know that there are some people who are embracing some of the newer methodologies in homeopathy, like the vital sensation method or some of these newer ideas that are being introduced into our study and practice of homeopathy. And recently there have even been some comments by some of these people that the classical, more traditional method, the Hahnemannian approach, is no longer necessary. These new approaches have subsumed and made the old classical method really unnecessary. I'm curious, what is your feeling on this?
I don't agree at all. Absolutely not. And more I feel I need to say to patients in different groups in different countries, please learn your basics. Familiarize yourself with your basics. Be sure you know your basics very well. And basics, I mean, you have to study your symptoms. You have to go to your old books. You have to learn your rubrics. You have to know them by heart. Because if you don't know them, you will not recognize them later. You will just go flying into your imagination, and you will lose all ground. And they don't like to hear it because it's boring, and you know, and they think it's unnecessary, and very often they think they can skip it, all those useless symptoms, but they can't. Because if I say sometimes by only the physical pathology, I could prescribe and make a vital prescription that's only on the basis of knowledge of your remedies. That you know, this is a modality, a very specific modality for this remedy, and that's why you recognize it. Because you're familiar with your remedies. And I tell patients, if you want to play the piano or the violin, you will have to practice every day. And you will have to do this for a few years. And later you will do it because you like it. But in the beginning you will dislike it because you have to, you know, you make your fingers a bit flexible and you have to do this automatically. And if you then have this in your fingers, then you can play. Then you can improvise. And there's no way to skip these first years of practicing every day. So I don't agree that it's outdated and you don't need it anymore. And it's because, see, the newer developments are built upon the basis we have. And they're just the next step. But you cannot take the next step and skip the first step. It's impossible. You have to have one stair, and then the second stair, and then the third, and then the fourth. And I think it's a big mistake to skip this or to even think that you can skip them. And I see the results, and they very often, sometimes they have a lucky shot, but very often the prescription has no fundament.
Real words of wisdom there. So I know, Anna, that you've studied with Rajan Sankaran, and your own approach is somewhat based on the vital sensation method. Can you delineate for us what is the difference between the vital approach and the vital sensation method.
Yeah, Sankar was my master for, I can say, for at least 15 years. But there's a moment that you have to leave your master, right? I think that's healthy, that you feel he learned you everything he could learn you. And I kind of, if I can say so, incorporated his wisdom and his knowledge and his insight, and I'm very grateful for that. What is the difference then? Why do I feel that there are enough differences to not introduce myself as a Sankaran follower or disciple anymore? I did in the past, but I think this would not be right because I don't follow his instructions so rigorously anymore. I just incorporated a lot and I owe to him, and you know, I will tell everybody like this is Sankaran's he did so much to give us so many insights and to speed up the development of homeopathy. But the differences are among the differences, and the reason why I didn't follow him anymore is the difficulty, can I put it that way, the difficulty to get your patient, to bring your patient to this vital level. In some patients, it just doesn't work. You can ask whatever you want, and they can't answer, or they are puzzled, they don't know what you're looking for, or they are willing to be helpful, and they start to use their imagination. And very often, and because I'm teaching, that's what I see happening with my students, very often the idea was, or the feeling was, I don't have a sensation case and I have nothing. I don't even have, a good classical case, so I have nothing to prescribe on. And with the students, over and over, I saw this frustration. Like for 4 years they were happily studying, and in the fifth year they were trying to reach the sensation level. They couldn't make it, and they were very frustrated, and they ended up with an enormous feeling of failure. Now, this is not the message I want to give my students. After 5 years of hard work, that they basically are going to fail. I don't think that's a good message after you give that diploma. So this was one reason that I thought this needs a little adjustment. The other reason was that I found myself like hammering the same nail in the consultation, asking the same question to get my patient to squeeze out the sensation of my patients. And actually, the consultation became boring and very often led nowhere. And the patients actually brought me back to reality, and sometimes I was hammering the nail and they would say, but that's not the reason why I'm here, you know. So let's say very quickly I learned to listen to my patients again, and I started to understand that whatever they say, that's their state, and whatever is from their state is from the vital. There's no way to hide it. I think every homeopath said it before. I had my aha after. And that it is right. The sensation method or the sensation idea is okay. I agree with it, that on the fifth level, on the sensation level, is the source of the problem. But you don't have to take your patient there to be sure. If you can spot the expressions of this sensation on other levels, you have a very solid case. And that's what I'm teaching. That's like, this is my happy message. Don't panic, don't worry. It's on level one. It's in the physical symptoms as well. It's in the emotions as well. It's in the psyche as well. It's everywhere. And it's all levels, all of the time. So this is a completely different case-taking. The first thing I wrote in The Charm of Homeopathy is, you have to listen to your patient because the patient always takes you where the treasure is hidden. He always takes you to the vital disturbance because that is where he's full of. His heart is full of this disturbance and it will come out of his mouth. If you just let him talk and listen very carefully, the patient will bring you to the area, the territory, where the problem is. And then, of course, as a homeopath, you know when when to dig. That's your technique. You have to have some techniques to know how to get it on the surface. But the patient will bring you there. So that's a main difference. Like, I would now advise everybody, listen to your patient, follow the patient, and don't interrupt, just encourage him to tell more about what he is wanting to tell you, even if you think it is superficial or it's not interesting or it's, you know, it's boring, whatever, or it's so trivial. Is this patient coming from, I don't know, 300 kilometers far, and did he wait for 2 months to tell me this trivial details? Well, it's not trivial. Since the patient wants to tell you, it must be vital. So we have to, let's say, not be prejudiced. Just listen, and what he tells us is the vital. Another difference is, maybe it's for practical, pragmatic reasons, I only use 5 levels instead of 7. Sankaran uses 7 levels. And I think we have enough with 5. I don't disagree with the 7. That it's not that I deny that the 6th level exists. The 6th level in Sankaran scheme is the substance or the source where the patient starts to talk source language. But I just consider this the same level as the 5th. It's a sensation and the source actually is more or less the same. And a lot of people might feel the energy of the 6th level, but they are unable to put it to words because it's pre-verbal, so they might draw it, or they might dance it, or they might sing it, but how to prescribe? You cannot prescribe on expressions of the energy. You need words, because homeopathy, the medium of homeopathy is language, so we do it by language. And then another, I think, for me, important difference is that Sankaran has level 1, it's physical, that's the same as I use. He uses level 2, and that's the individualized pathology. It's the facts that the patient will tell you about his physical complaint. And as far as I understand, every physical complaint is individualized. You cannot have anybody else's pathology. You always have your own pathology, so it is individual as level 1. But there is an energetic aspect in the body, and that's the invisible level of function. It's the immune system, it's the hormonal system, it's the endocrine system. So it's all those systems that have, of course, their results on the physical body. But in themselves, they are not physical. If you put a person under a scan, you cannot see his pain. The patient can cramp up his muscles because he has pain, but you cannot see pain. If somebody with migraine is examined, there's nothing wrong with his head. But still, he feels the pain. Or when there's a hormonal disturbance, you cannot say where or who cause this disturbance, but you can see the results, of course, of hormonal disturbances in the physical body. And the same with the immune system. You cannot see the immune system under the microscope, but of course you can see the results in the blood of a good or bad working immune system. So that's the level 2. It's the vitality, it's the energy, it's the functional aspect of the physical body. And I think it's important to include this level, because as a homeopath, we see a lot of patients with problems on the 2nd level. So they have physical complaints, but they're not really the material physical complaints, but they come from the functional or the energetic level. So they suffer from pain, and there's no solution for it, and painkillers is not a long-term solution, so they see a homeopath for it, or they have problems with their energy. The energy is drained, or they have chronic problems like chronic fatigue syndrome, and that's a problem of the, in my view, of the 2nd level, the energetic level. And as far as I can see, the Hahnemannian miasms are also situated on the 2nd level. It's the constitutional weaknesses that are inherited, the tendencies that you're born with. You cannot see them under a microscope, but you can see the effects in the liability for some diseases, and the tendencies or the susceptibility to get some diseases. And then level 3 is more or less the same, emotional. Level 4 is a little bit of difference. Sankaran call it level of delusions. And I, let's say, broadened it a little bit. Delusions are only a part of the psyche. You have the conscious, the subconscious, and the unconscious mind. And delusions are on the subconscious. But the psyche of a person has more levels. So he has this rational part that you are... say, meeting in a consultation that you are talking with when the patient gives his ideas, his analysis, whatever, and you have the subconscious, we have techniques to uncover those, and then you have the unconscious that sometimes comes up in dreams or in myths or anything. So these levels are not there with Sankaran, he only uses the subconscious. Which for homeopathic use is necessary. I mean, we base very often our symptoms, or we use the symptoms from this level, the unconscious mental level.
Very interesting.
So,
Ani, you know, I've taught in Japan and I've spent quite a bit of time there, and some of the feedback that I got, because you were talking earlier about the case taking a part of your vital approach method as being a little bit different from the vital sensation method. And one of the things that I heard quite a bit in Japan was that the vital sensation questioning method, the way of taking the case, was actually intimidating for many Japanese people, that they found it a little bit too aggressive. And I'm curious, have you found that your approach, it being a little bit different than the vital sensation method, is better for certain cultures or nations? Or what is your experience with this?
It could be. Maybe that's why I said that a little adjustment for, let's say, Belgian people or Western European people, because the things you maybe can afford yourself to do in India are not the same things that you can do in Belgium. Like, for instance, in India they put a video camera on you, whether you like it or not. I've seen patients who said, I don't like this video camera. And while the camera was running, they say, why not? I mean, in full public, this is something impossible in Belgium. Mm. That's crossing a boundary. You just cannot do this. Mm. The patient would just walk out, and he would be right, because you don't even ask him, and against his will, you cannot video a person. But maybe there are cultures that say, okay, that's the way I work, and if people want to be helped by me, then they have to, they have to take it. They have to agree with being videoed. Okay, that's one thing. Intimidating, I said boring, because what happens sometimes is that the patient wanted to tell you something, and you, let's say me, I thought that I knew better, that no, I don't want your story, because, you know, the story is not where the fight is. I don't want your story, I just want your sensation. And then the patient had also a feeling like of boredom, like he was forced to talk about something he didn't want to talk about. It was, and the time was going by, was passing by, and he didn't have a chance to talk about his real problem. So I don't know if it's intimidating, but it's like afterwards, I thought it's not very respectful to force yourself into, force your patient into something while he's just too eager to tell you something. And I think out of respect, at least we can listen to our patients. Of course, I know some patients talk too long and repeat themselves too often and give more of the same, and you already understood. And then we can tell them, but we can tell them, let's say, in a nice way, like, I understood what you said, I agree, but can you... In general, I would say, if you would be there with the case-taking, you would feel like it's a very relaxed conversation. It's not a dialogue. It's me making the person tell me how he really feels. Eh? So it's not a dialogue. We don't have a back and forth, but that's a therapeutic relationship. Eh? We're not friends. But it's relaxed. The patient can tell whatever he wants. And if it's a little bit difficult, I might crack a joke or whatever and make the atmosphere a bit lighter, and then we go on. See, so it's not me bossing them around or
Right.
But just very gentle, very gentle. Mm. And if they needed a little push, that's all.
Very good. Anna, I know that you're going to be showing some very interesting cases at the Joint American Conference in Alexandria, Virginia in April. And I'm curious, the vital approach, I know you're going to discuss that. Could you talk a little bit about the advantages in general of the vital approach and specifically how you use this approach to solve the cases that you're going to be presenting at the conference?
Yes, sure. That's why I chosen the case. One is, let's say, solved without a vital approach, but then in retrospect, afterwards, we can see that the information that we didn't use at that time was already there and probably would have given us even more security. But I want to demonstrate that it's not the only way and it's the only good way, at the contrary. It's not that that we didn't make good prescriptions before and all of a sudden now we all see in the light and now we are all wonderful prescribers and the things before were useless. Sometimes I have to tell people, 15 years ago, even then homeopaths had cured cases and made nice prescriptions, see, by understanding your patient. So it's not... Basically, it's not so different. It's not so different. You still have to understand your patient. What is different? That a vital approach can navigate you somehow through the case. So you know you're aiming your question at level 5 and you know, is the patient answering? Is it level 5, level 4, level 3? So you know where you are. It's more controlled in a way. You know, sentence by sentence, where you are, what kind of information you get. While in the past, the experience I had was we made the patient talk and we got a whole lot of information and afterwards we tried to make sense out of it. While now, by doing the case, you know exactly where you're heading. You're heading at level 5 and you know when you have a stepping stone to go to the next. So it's a navigator. You can say it's a compass through your case taking. You know what to look for. You know when it's an expression of the vital or not. And how do you know? You know on level 1, when it doesn't belong to the pathology, must belong to the patient. What belongs to the patient is vital. Level 2, I told you, is the disturbances in the energy. It's miasma information, generalities. So that's all good, solid homeopathic information. Level 3, we know where the patient start to tell story. Me, not only my complaint, but me. That's the way I am. That is what my complaint does with me. It irritates me. It worries me. So we get some emotion, spontaneous emotional stuff. If the patient is coming up with it spontaneously, we ask a bit more. We get a bit more story. The patient will say, but I'm always worried because I'm the kind of type that... And they tell about themselves. We don't prescribe on the story, but we prescribe on how the story is experienced. So we need the story, in a way, to know what is vital. Why does the patient tell this particular anecdote? Why does he want to give me this particular example? Because it's never coincidental. So we listen very careful, and we use this information because we know in the example must be something vital. Otherwise, he would not even have to tell this in the first place. If he didn't ask, if it comes spontaneous. If we ask, it's always possible that the patient is just answering a question. But answering a question, you can do by your rational mind. It's like making an examination. It's question and answer. But if it comes spontaneously, it comes from the vital. It's something the patient wants to tell you. And that's important. So it's a navigator. It's knowing that the vital disturbance is on all levels, and it's helping you to see the pattern, because it makes a pattern. And the pattern is then what will lead us to a solid prescription. If necessary, we look into the rubrics. Very often they are helpful. Sometimes we miss the information, because not all remedies are well proven and some remedies will be lacking. But we will have an idea, because most likely the better known family members will come up in the repertorization. So for me, this is the advantages. The frustration is not there, or less. The fear of failure is not there. You're feeling, I can see it, I can do it, because I get information from every level, and every level of a patient, all levels are interesting again. It's not, you know, waiting a bit bored for the patient to jump to the fifth level and then all of a sudden think, oh, that's interesting. Because that was, I think, a disadvantage, I don't know how it is now, of the beginning period of the sensation method. The cases were endless. They took 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. They were endless, endless. And very often, the bulk of the information was useless. Yeah. Well, I feel now, with this vital approach, every bit and piece of information, most of it is useful if you know what to do with it.
Interesting. And we're running a little bit short on time. I wanted to ask you about some of the things that you're involved in. Can you tell us a little bit about your books? And also, will your Dutch books be translated into English? I think it would be useful for people to have access to those.
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, the Dutch books that you mentioned are, in fact, for the general public. So maybe in all kinds of languages, there are all kinds of books like that. But I felt at that time it was necessary. And it was necessary because I was the head of the school and of a center for homeopathy to make clear what we were doing and from what theoretical background we were doing, what we were doing, and how is our position, let's say social and cultural. So these Dutch books, these first two books, is more for the local community. Now the English books, The Charm, is translated in a few languages, in French, in Serbian, and in Bulgarian. And The Vital Approach, which you didn't mention yet, a book that I published last year, is translated in a few languages. I think it's not available yet, but there is a Dutch translation, and there is a Czech translation. And there is another book that you didn't mention yet, because it's very new, probably you don't know, and the title would be even harder because it's Dutch again. It's Voorbij Lichaam en Geest, and it means Beyond Mind and Body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's again a selection of cases. But since I teach a lot in Holland and I teach a lot in Belgium, and the other book with cases is in English, I thought it was now a good idea to have a real selection of model cases from all kingdoms and all ages. And, you know, so from the master classes of the last year, I took the best examples. Mm-hmm. And with a lot of comments, how to evaluate the information you get. So it's cut in bits and pieces and with a lot of comments. So the theory is intertwined in the cases. That's the last book. I don't know if that will ever be translated. And The Vital Approach is, let's say, in English, but it's read by the Dutch or other communities with ease, because it's in an easy language.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you're considered internationally to be a very top-level prescriber, and you demonstrate that in your seminars by actually doing live cases in front of the large audiences, and I understand that the results are very, very good. I also know that you're working now to create this collection of cured cases of kind of smaller remedies that are not perhaps easily seen in practice because we're not that familiar with them, and this is going to be made available in the new Opus program. Can you tell us a little bit about these cases and what you're hoping to achieve by making these available to the community?
Yeah, sure. That's a project I'm working on now. It's a lot of work, I must say, because, you know, I make a lot of notes to begin with in at verbatim, the words of the patient. So often, most cases are, let's say, 10 pages to start with. That's an intake and then the follow-up. So to transcript all those cases, make them shorter, because they're too long. Nobody will read every word of that, and it's not all relevant. And to shorten up the follow-ups, because you need a few follow-ups to have a good demonstration, that's a lot of work. So why would I do all this work? Because I feel by using this method, another advantage is that you don't have to limit yourself to the known remedies. You can almost literally use whatever remedy is available or not yet available, but that you feel that's the pattern of the disturbance, that fits with this kind of remedy. So sometimes the remedy is unknown or it's not proven. It's somewhere in the book listed without proving, or it has a few clinical symptoms, or it's made on, it's got in the books because of assumptions. It might be a good remedy against this and that, with not reliable proving. But if your method is good and you can prescribe a rare remedy, and then you have a good reaction, and I mean a vital reaction, like the patient is cured on all levels and permanently, then it would be, I think, very useful for the homeopathic community to have an insight, to have this information available. It's somewhere in my cupboard otherwise.
Right.
And the students who happen to be present, they know, but that's a little group in this country, a little group in this country. So if there could be tags, and you could do a search to these cases, it would help a lot. For instance, we use a few, let's say, Monera bacteria and virus cases. How many do we know? Mm. And how many do we use? So I have quite a few that have reacted very, very well with total cure, and those patients were sometimes sick for years and couldn't be helped anywhere, and they were not functioning, and the body was, they were not able to work or do anything, and you can give a good Monera, I mean, a vital prescription, and the whole patient, the whole situation clears up in weeks, and the patient is just another person. And those are, this kind of information is still lacking, is still missing. So the idea is, the aim is, the purpose is to make it available, because there are the schemes, my schemes, but that, of course, is very short, only words. And then there's the full text in the Encyclopedia Homeopathica. And we are now going to make, like, little files with explanation, like the intermediate in between. The words mean this. If you want to read the full text, you can go to the encyclopedia, and you can find an example in the database. I think then it's all around. Then people can say, oh, really? A nose rot. Ah, and this is the way how I can spot a nose rot. Mm-hmm. These are the words. Oh, and there's a case. Oh, and that is how the patient would verbalize it. That is how the patient experiences it. Then you have the words of the patient. It's almost like a proving. And for the time being, since we don't have proofs, I think it's a good addition to our homeopathic knowledge.
Very interesting. Anna, do you have other projects going on right now that you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, there's a blog. Is that the information?
yeah, sure.
There's a blog, so there's about weekly. I put on this blog my ideas. It's WordPress, I think. Yeah, WordPress.com, and then my name. And it's working since a few weeks. And so I have an administrator who helps me out. And it's like, we have those ideas, and we have those sketches, and we have drafts, and I have all kind of things lying around that someday maybe will be useful for a book. But in this time, it's such quick developments, I think it's better to share with the community so people can react and we can all work together. So that's the new project that I started up a few weeks ago only.
Very good. And also, what about your Center of Classical Homeopathy in Leuven? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the Center of Classical Homeopathy actually is now in the hands of Crystal Lombard. So for the last 5-6 years, she's doing all the administration. The school is hers, and she leads the center, so I'm not the director anymore. But we work together closely, and with colleagues. She works in the group practice, so she's one of my homeopathic colleagues. And, of course, I still teach in the school. Now she's my boss, which is kind of funny, because she was my student before. Now she's my boss. And we work together for training the teachers, and supervising and the last year students, that's, and the clinical training of the students, that's still for important bit my still my work. That's what I'm doing there. But I established a new company, which is the White Room, and basically it's editing the books and organizing my seminars and training. So I have master classes in Belgium, in which I do life cases, you already mentioned it. And since there are not too many homeopaths doing that, and since I feel that the students really, really need it, clinical training, and I get positive reactions like, please, Ed, do this. And so I have two groups in Holland. I have these master classes with life cases, and I have a group in Czechia and a group in Serbia. So mainly this is the same thing I'm doing in Belgium, but now on four different places. So I go to all those places several times a year, stay there for a few days, and do life cases explaining my approach by demonstrating it, seeing the patients. And most often the patients come from the students who are practicing homeopaths. It's a master class. It's for advanced learning. And they bring their difficult cases. So I see the patients once, but they are followed up by the homeopaths who were already treating them.
Fantastic.
And yeah.
And what about Anna, future plans? What can we expect from you in the future? What will you be working on in projects, books, seminars? What can you share with us?
Long-term future, as far as I can see in my agenda, sometimes I have to go to my own websites and look at my agenda where I am. But I'm fully booked until, let's say, at least after the summer next year. So I'm teaching every week. And what I'm doing in between is seeing patients, of course. And then the writing goes on because it's two things. The writing is for a part, is partly theoretical, and now I'm putting this in my blog, and the other part is, let's say, practical, and these are cases and insights, and as I told Dale before, it's like the grammar is a theory of the homeopathy, but interests me, the philosophy, and the cases are the vocabulary, and both are necessary. So I'm very busy doing both, and I don't know the future plan. Let's say the future is already almost fully booked by doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah, so I will be, you know, in Washington and in San Francisco.
Yeah, let me mention that again. So for people who joined us a little bit late, Anna Pravaka will be teaching a seminar in the Bay Area, and the date again for that is, can you tell us again?
Must be 25th, 26th, 27th of March.
25th, 26th, and 27th of March. And as Marcy mentioned at the beginning of the call, Anna Pravaka's seminars are very well received. She's really an excellent prescriber, gets very good results, and she really goes through the process of her thinking in terms of the cases, taking, you know, stopping it, really explaining what she's doing so that people can walk away from these seminars with the ability to actually duplicate what Anna's actually doing in her own practice. It's not that she's just standing up there as the master homeopath and putting on a magic show. She actually makes it intelligible to the audience so that they can actually walk away with the skill set necessary to emulate what she actually does in her own practice. Also, Anna will be one of a number of lecturers at the Joint American Conference. It's a star-studded lineup. You know, everybody from George Matulkas to Jeremy Scher to Joe Kellerstein to Miranda Castro to Alistair Gray to Farouk Master to Will Taylor and many, many more. I think there's a total of 25, 30 different speakers. I'll be speaking on coughs. So it's really going to be Massimo Mangiovori, just a fantastic event, and there'll be the unveiling of this global homeopathy video, and there'll even be a formal dialogue among all the different teachers about different aspects of homeopathic practice, which will be quite engaging. I'll be actually moderating that. So this is going to be an amazing event and an opportunity to spend time with colleagues and friends and also enjoy the Washington, D.C. area during the cherry blossom season. It's really something, if you can make it out there, that you won't want to miss. And, of course, you'll have the opportunity to study with Anna Vravaka. She'll be showing some fantastic long-term cure cases using her method, and you'll get a sense of the different ways that practitioners employ homeopathy in contemporary practice today. So with that, let me go ahead and open it up for other people's questions. We don't have too much time, just a few minutes, but certainly we can have time for a question or two. So let me go ahead and open up the lines now. Does anybody who's on would like to ask a question? Don't be shy. This is your opportunity. Anna is calling all the way from Belgium. Anybody have any questions they'd like to ask?
Hello?
Yes, hello, please.
Well,
what's your name, first of all?
My name is Linda.
Hi, Linda.
I have used homeopathy myself and my daughters, and I'm very like inexperienced, but very inspired listening to Anna. And I guess I was wondering, is there? Well, I work with people in doing the 12-step program for people that have been affected by alcoholism. And I was wondering if you have success with those, type of issues.
Hey, Anna, yes. Did you hear the question?
Yes. Can I understand it like this? Do I have experience with people who are addicted to alcohol or something else?
Well, when you were talking about inheriting those kind of symptoms, I feel that I was affected by alcoholism, but I'm not addicted. I don't have any addictions, but I feel that I have inherited certain things that have come from that, and trying to figure out, what is the imbalance or what, you know, and so when I hear you speak, I just feel that I would be, could really, something could be uncovered in this vital approach.
Well, this is possible because we try to make the whole picture, and we try to see if there's some tendency or where it comes from or why or how it works. So that's an individualized inquiry. So it's not, you're not asking like, do you have experience with addictions, because that's a whole different question. But if there's some time or tendency, some kind of tendency underlying that you are born with, it's possible. We use this miasmatic theory to explain this. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but in even classical homeopathy, it's a basic idea. It's only used in homeopaths, between homeopaths, miasms. It's a bit a funny word, but it means like this underlying, this inherited born tendencies. And of course, sure, yeah, we're treating that. We take it into consideration.
Okay, very good. Unfortunately, Anna, we're out of time. I see it's right on the hour. I know you'll come back and do more of these calls with us. I know because you're so supportive of us, and also I consider you a very good friend, and I know you'll always be happy to join us again, even though you do have a very busy schedule. Let me open up the lines and let everyone thank you personally for joining us. We know that you've got a very full plate and you just finished teaching for 8 hours, and we really greatly appreciate it. So everyone give Anna Vravaka a big North American thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, listen, everyone, have a very good day. Hope to see you in Alexandria, Virginia. And if you have any more questions, also, we'll be sending out information about Anna's seminar in the Bay Area as well, so you'll be able to find the link and website information for that. All right. I hope everyone has a very good rest of your weekend. Thank you. And thank you, Anna.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.